Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl, and this is the ISF podcast. With me today is my co-host, Limes. Say hello, Limes.
Good evening, everybody.
Okay, and today is our special Halloween episode, and we are very, very happy to have on with us John Amplis. John, you would know from various films from that were directed by George Romero, and John has been on a couple podcasts with me previously. So, John, it's really, really nice to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here. Happy Halloween.
Well, happy Halloween. Thank you, sir.
Back at you.
There you go.
So I would think that, you know, this is a pretty special time for you with your background and all the films you did with George, that this is sort of where you remember him, more or less.
Well, sure. It's a, you know, George's legacy is pretty special. Personally, Halloween is not a great, it's great, but it's not my personal thing, you know, but I'm happy to help celebrate it.
And we're happy to have you here.
Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Incredibly Strange Films, but it's a Facebook group that I got connected with, and we have over 275,000 members. And I can guarantee you at least once or twice a week, somebody is going to post Martin. And of course,
fabulous.
That was your first film and you know,
just
I think a tour de force.
We'll start there. Yeah, cool. Right. It's George's favorite and mine as well, for certainly obvious reasons for me. I never considered it a horror film per se. It's more for me a kind of psychological character study and thriller. But what I am amazed about with the film is that it's continually finding new audiences, you know. In fact, I mean, you know, it's taken over the last 44 years, because it was shot in 76. It's slowly gained in popularity amongst George's other films. And, you know, what I keep being amazed about is that it's seen by a new generation, you know, continually. Everybody now, I think it's getting more attention now, certainly, than it got when it was first released, believe it or not. I'm pretty excited about that.
It's a film for me that really focuses on your character, and of course, it's never specifically mentioned whether or not you are a vampire. You certainly don't have fangs. You use
right.
a syringe.
Rebuke. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. Go ahead, John. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's kind of a rebuke of the traditional thoughts about vampirism and also the traditional from the side of superstition. And, you know, Martin says it in the film, you know, there is no magic. This is not not about me turning into a bat and flying. Mm-hmm. There's no magic going on here. And George says that in many ways in this movie, I think. In 1976, Braddock is another large character in this movie. The fact that we were at that very time losing all the industry, where all of the immigrants that lived along the rivers of Pittsburgh, grew up, made their money. All these little mill towns were going bust. The old days were moving out, and Martin has no part or interest in the traditions and the superstitions, I think he did think he was a vampire. Obviously he did, but not the kind of vampire that we have all grown up with in terms of Bram Stoker and, Vlad the Impaler. Not that guy.
No, and one of the scenes I remember is Kuda, who we'll get to in a moment. He has the garlic on the door, and Martin goes right through it, and like, this doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, right. He takes a nice big bite out of it. It's about the loss of the, it's about, hey, let's get real here. What you believe in really doesn't exist. Your old superstitions and all of that nonsense don't really exist. It's also a little bit about, I think, nature versus nurture. Martin is probably who he is, not because he believes himself to be 84. I think he was talked into believing that. I think he was told that. I think he, and if you're told something, indoctrinated, in that fashion, over and over and over again, well, you start to believe it yourself. So I think I think Martin was really just George used to say this too, a crazy mixed up kid.
I also love the whole thing with the radio station.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Right. Mike Gornick, our cinematographer, played that role, Barry, on the radio. And, Martin himself was debunking all of the thoughts about, what a vampire is.
All the tropes and,
Yes, they were, none of that was real. What was real is that, this kid had developed, I think, and I thought of, I didn't think of this, early on, but over the years, it certainly has crossed my mind that what Martin really is an addict. He had no resistance, to being with women in that way, other than, unfortunately, taking their blood and ultimately killing them.
Right. No. So Limes, do you have any questions for John?
Yeah, actually, I do have a question there. And oddly enough, I think John kind of took us to the place. John, nice to meet you, Limes.
Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot, sir. So I was watching the show. I was watching Martin again last night because I thought this is an ideal time to give it a revisit. And
yeah.
something that occurred to me, I was very drawn to your look in the film. You know, like, you very much sell it, you know, with the eyes, and you've got the look with the hair, and you've kind of, when you talk to especially female horror fans that I've spoken to, a lot of people, a lot of them are very drawn to that character of Martin. They find him very, you know, kind of, right, attractive. You've probably run into it. So the question I have is, I'm wondering, coming at the time that Martin did, when, you know, we just kind of, a couple of years earlier, we'd had Clockwork Orange, and there was this turn to these kind of teenager sort of like rebellious characters, dark characters, and you fit that mold. Was there ever anybody ever kind of approach you and try to sort of turn you into like that kind of, that sort of archetype, that Malcolm McDowell kind of archetype there?
No, I wish they had. you know, it was kind of bittersweet after Martin was released. It got a lot of good press. My performance got a lot of good press, but I didn't have anyone kind of on my side to help me business-wise, and I certainly didn't know a lot about the business at that point. I mean, I was 27 when I shot it, but I was still just out of college and didn't have a lot of experience in the professional world. And so after we shot Martin, I moved to New York. And, you know, what you did at that point as an actor is you pounded the pavements. One of the problems, too, is not enough people saw Martin. And so it was kind of relegated to the back of the room. And they were already working on... George was already working on the script for Dawn of the Dead, and the very next year shot Dawn of the Dead. Laurel themselves were kind of busy. So Martin just kind of got lost in the background. I think there were some distribution issues with the movie, and at the time... they weren't looking at the actors in George's films as much as they were looking at George. And so George's films were about George, not so much about the actors in it. But I think, I agree. I think I would have loved to have gotten some support in terms of how do I go about now doing this? How do I work in this business? I needed management. I needed an agent. I needed all of those things. Unfortunately, because of the limited release of Martin, nobody saw it, and nobody in the business was paying any attention to it. So, such is life, right? if it had been Stanley Kubrick, like Malcolm McDowell had, maybe I would have had Malcolm's career. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I was Johnny Depp before Johnny Depp.
Okay, I can go with that. I can work with that.
That wins, yeah.
Anyway, the point being, it didn't work out that way, and so be it. My life really worked out pretty well because I worked in the theater all of my life. So it wasn't that I didn't just do Romero movies. I've done over 50 plays as an actor and probably another 50 plays as a director. So I spent 36 years at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and just retired a couple of years ago. So I've had a career, but most of it's been on stage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a career I'm really very proud of and happy to have had. There was a time during the time I made five movies, actually six, but you don't see me in the last one, The Dark House. Yeah, because I was Timothy Hutton's double. And I was his acting partner because he had to play two characters in it. And so whenever he had to be on screen with this other character, I would play the other character off camera, so that he could do whichever character he was in at the time. So I never really got seen in it, so it's okay. my point being was in five. The other five films that I did with George, I would come back from. I came back from New York to work on Dawn, and I just wanted to be involved. So they allowed me to do some casting, in fact, I was able to get David Emge, Flyboy, into Dawn of the Dead. He was an old friend of mine from the Playhouse when I was a student.
Wow.
And yeah. And when I moved to New York, I caught up with David again, and we both, in Dawn certainly, but in all of George's films, there's a lot of people that came out of this little restaurant that Christine Forrest used to work in and had friends that worked in it. And so I was able to get a job there. And so I was waiting tables and bartending. And I got David a job as a cook. And it was Lady Asker's wonderfully decadent little bar, restaurant, directly across from the public theater on Lafayette Street in New York. So we'd get a lot.
I know exactly where it was. Know exactly where it was.
Cool. Yeah. And so there were a lot of us that were working there. Scott Reiniger was worked on and off there. So a lot, a lot of actors and theater people get jobs in restaurants because they can come and go. So a lot of people came out of Lady Astor's that George and Christine then utilized in his films. So yeah, it was pretty cool. But I would come back to Pittsburgh, and when I did something with George, I would then invariably get a job at the Playhouse and do some acting, and then I'd go back to New York. And then I'd come back in for another movie, or I'd come back in for a play, and then I'd get another shot at another movie. So I kept doing that, for like 6 years.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Now, I do want to go back a little bit to Martin, and I mentioned Cuda.
Yes,
And I want you to talk a little bit about Lincoln Maisel. And then, of course, I'm going to mention his son also.
Yes.
But how was it working with Lincoln?
Lincoln was wonderful. I mean, he was, he came out of vaudeville. And so he did a lot of things. He too worked at the Pittsburgh Playhouse back in its earlier days, 40s and 50s. Lincoln was great. His wife, started a program here in Pittsburgh called Gateway to Music. And of course, you were mentioning Lauren, who was the Pittsburgh Symphony conductor for quite a long time. But Lincoln was he was wonderful to work with, and very funny and a kind, sensitive guy, and I loved him, you know. And he lived to be 106 years old.
God, he, you know, I take a look at that relationship between the two of you in that film, and you could just tell that it just so meshed so well, that you worked so well together.
Oh,
and you know, I always loved that him as an actor. And that's the one thing about George, he always seemed to get really good actors that people didn't know at the time, you know, Richard Liberty being another one. Of course, we'll get to Richard Liberty later. But, you know, just a wonderful, wonderful film. So
I'd like to jump in and ask another question, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
About before we move off of Martin, because there's one other thing that I wanted to ask that hit me last night. Without giving any spoilers to anyone in the viewers or to the listeners that may not have seen it, was Martin's ultimate fate in the movie, was that always set in stone, John?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was in the text. Everything you see on in the film was written. We did very little any kind of improvisation, or there was really no need to it. It was such a tight text. It was longer, as you're I'm sure aware. There was a much longer cut of the film.
I heard
that was
Yeah,
2.5, maybe 3 hours. But I don't think, in spite of that particular print being gone or lost, I don't think there was anything lost in the story as the film sits at its 91, 92 minutes. You know, the story is, I think, very, very clear. Everything came from the text. There was except for the marching band.
Oh, really?
We had just finished a scene. I think it was the scene with when Chris, Tina, Christine, and Sabini are getting in the car and they're leaving. They're leaving together, but they're not going to stay together. So we had just finished that scene. And so we heard this marching band that was like two blocks away. And so we somebody got the idea, well, let's go down and shoot it. And, John, you jump in to the we'll shoot you marching in the marching band and following the crowd. So that's what we did. I mean, I got a lot of strange looks at the time, but you know, that's what happened. You know, what's this crazy kid doing marching around with us? We don't know him. But, that was the only piece of improvisation that I recall that was added to the original story.
Excuse me, gentlemen, we have a caller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
we
I'm
have
bringing
a caller.
Them in. Yep, they should be live in just a moment. There we go.
What's happening?
Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Oh, it's Danae. Hi, Danae.
Hello.
Hello, caller. caller.
So, Danae, do you have any questions for John?
Yes. How are you enjoying your Father's Day cake?
Well, that, yeah, Father's Day has been, become a really big deal for me over the years. Now, I do have a son, 22, but he doesn't pay any attention to Father's Day or to his father, for that matter. I have a picture somewhere on my Facebook, if you delve into my photos, you can probably find it. It's me eating a big cookie cake and in lieu of Father's Day cake. But anyway, I'm continually having to celebrate Father's Day. When I go to conventions, I've been honored with cake all in I don't know, probably 15 states already.
Do you ever get tired of it?
No, of course not. No. I'm very appreciative.
That's good to hear. So what have you been up to?
Well, I retired from my day job in the theater a couple of years ago, and I bought a house, an old house that has, four different yards. And so I spend most of my time outside if I can. And I just got a boxer dog, who's 4.5 years old, and he's looking at me now, wondering why I'm talking about him. And I spend a very quiet time, looking around the house and seeing what I have to fix up next. So that's what I do mostly. I'm recently part of this because of COVID. We can't have conventions anymore. Excuse me. So I'm part of this authentic autographs. And so I can sign autographs through them. All you have to do is sign up with authentic autographs. And they you can send in your own material, or you can ask for an 8x10. Or whatever paraphernalia that I may have in that. Actually, I do have a Father's Day, a Nathan Grantham little, what do they call it, model or statue or boy.
I know there's an action figure now, right?
Yes, I am. Nate is an action figure. So that's what's happening right now, and I'm gonna do a Zoom play on the 30th with some old friends. They're in New York, and I'm here, but they've asked me to be a part of this Zoom play. It's a 3-character play written by Wallace Shawn. If you know who Wallace Shawn is.
Oh,
I do.
Inconceivable.
Yeah.
inconceivable.
He's a terrific playwright, though. I mean, really, really smart guy. And so he wrote this play in the 90s. And doggone it, if the name of it isn't, I'm forgetting it right at the very moment. Wait, I'll find it. Hold on. It's dark in here.
That happened to all of us, John. Trust me.
Wait, I got it. Nope, that's not it. I'm in my office and I can't find the light. Anyhow, it's something mourner. It's the Oh, shit. Excuse my French. Anyway, I'm going to do that.
Don't worry about it, John. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I'm not.
Okay.
Anyway, that's happening. So.
Cool. Sounds like you've had a nice full life, and you're still living it up. See,
I wouldn't say living it up, but I'm living okay. I'm doing all right. No doubt about that.
As long as you're happy.
That's the key, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Are you a fan?
Danae is actually part of the podcast group, too. She does her own show.
Are you? Oh, fabulous. Oh, you do?
Yeah, yeah. And I have to admit, when I saw Martin, I didn't really like it that well because, well, I was younger. I think I was like maybe 14.
You had no business watching Martin at 14.
That didn't stop me. I saw a lot of things I shouldn't have seen at that age.
You horror fans are mature beyond your years.
Thank you. Anyway, you know, ever since I was like maybe 6 years old, I know that sounds weird, I've been a huge vampire fan. And I think the reason why I didn't like Martin was because it wasn't like any vampire movie that I had ever seen. But the more times I'm 52 now, and the more times I've watched it since then, I have learned to appreciate it. And you know what? I think you are one of the most underrated actors there is out there. No, I'm serious. I'm not just fangirling.
Well,
I mean,
I think maybe a better way to say that, rather than underrated, is to say, you know, unknown, maybe.
You should be known for more than just Martin and the Father's Day segment of Creepshow.
Yes, right. Well, I was in Day of the Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Knight Riders with George as well.
I love Knight Riders. Where were you?
I was the mime, Whiteface.
Oh, okay.
I saved the little baby.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that actually brings up a question. You know, with Knight Riders, of course, that's one of Ed Harris's first films, and of course, also working on Creepshow, you're working with such good people that sort of thing. How was it, particularly with Creepshow, since that was George's foray into I think Universal put it out, if I remember. I can't remember. But in the studio.
Yeah,
work. How did that differ in terms of how the production was as opposed to doing something with George, you know, independently?
No difference. Yeah, no difference whatsoever. I was only in the first segment, so I didn't, because everything was shot in different locations and out of state as well, in other states. So I didn't have the opportunity to see all of that. But one of the things about George is, I mean, not only did he use a bunch of us that kind of became for a few years, you know, a kind of repertory company of his, but his crew, when we shot Martin, his crew was with him, the same crew that shot Martin was on everything else that he shot here in Pittsburgh.
Right.
So,
and we'll get to some of the crew, but the whole thing about that is it's like a family, right? I mean, you know, you're working with the same people and you know them, and it becomes very comfortable, I think.
Yeah.
In those terms, I would think.
That's how we talk about ourselves as well. If that, you know, when we go to conventions or anything like that, we're always referring to one another as a family, because it, you know, it was good for George to have people around that he could trust, and he didn't have to worry about and think about. And it was good for us because we kept getting work. And, you know, we're all still very good friends, and we still talk and see one another, you know, at least a few times a year. We've gone to England together. We've gone to various conventions together. So we're all still very good friends, both cast,
That's
both
awesome.
People, actors, both actors and crew members.
Mm-hmm.
Just like getting back.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'll let you talk. I sometimes ramble on too much.
Oh, no, not at all.
No, ramble on. We love it.
I was going to say, if I may,
yes.
I was going to say there, John, I noticed because you mentioned the UK, and obviously that's my hood. That's my territory.
I was going to ask. Yeah, I noticed your accent.
I'm a London boy. But I can tell you, Day of the Dead in particular went over absolutely huge over there. That was one of the biggest movies when I was a teenager there, when I was 14 when that came out. It was massive in the UK. So I'm going to guess you get a pretty good reception when you go to the conventions over there.
I've been over there at least three times, and I go to the convention that has been it's only had four outings or five outings, but it's in Manchester. Oh, my friends are going to kill me. Again, I'm trying to come up with the name of the damn thing. WOTD. Does that sound right?
W-O...
I want to say TD. Now I'm thinking about what do those words mean? What do those letters mean?
I'm trying to think of that one myself, actually.
I know. Golly, geez, this is terrible. My friends in the UK are going to hear this and say, "What the hell is the matter with him?" I have made some of the best friends in the UK, and people that I communicate on a very regular basis. The guy that helped to organize this convention, his name is Marcus Lewis, and he and his wife have done a tremendous job, and it's a nice, small, contained, intimate kind of convention, and what's wonderful about it is that they volunteer for this. Nobody gets paid over there other than the actors and the guests that they bring in, and they take such wonderful care of us. You can't imagine. I mean, I've stayed at Marcus's home on several occasions. I was able to took my son with me the last time we went, which was I think last November. No, it was in February, the last weekend of February. Just before COVID hit.
Oh, goodness. Right.
I got off the plane. My son and I got off the plane. And several days later, we were in quarantine.
Oh, wow.
Brutal.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Weekend of the Dead.
Okay.
Weekend of the Dead. That's it. WOTD.
Yep.
Okay. There you go.
Yes. Yeah, Weekend of the Dead.
Okay.
I don't know if they're going to do another one. I just did a, I just did another interview. It was a Zoom interview with a group there called the Outlaws, and we must have talked for I don't know an hour and a half, and they had to trim it because of my jabbering on and on and on.
Well, okay, we're not going to trim this one. You jabber on as much as you want, John.
Absolutely.
Well, what, you know, John, what I was... All right, somebody else asked a question. Go.
Sorry, John. I was just going to actually kind of finish a thought there, and that is that I think part of the reason as well that things like Day of the Dead and Creepshow, you know, went over so huge in the UK is because, and you probably know this from going over there for horror cons, we were so censored in the 80s. Like, so censored over there.
Oh.
So things like,
right.
Yeah. Just, well, you know, it was just, it was the political way of things. All crimes kind of became, sort of got lumped in on horror movies. So as such,
yeah,
a lot of movies were trimmed or outright banned over there. So Day of the Dead, it was, Day of the Dead, it was kind of one of those ones that sort of snuck through with a lot of gore intact, and I think that shocked the hell out of a lot of teenagers. But we loved you and Sarah, and you and Lori and everybody in here.
Yeah, Lori Cardill, yep.
So,
Lori
need to jump in here, because I got to tell a quick story.
Okay,
so 5 years ago, I did a podcast, and I did a podcast in memory of Ralph Marrero. Ralph played Rickles, in Day of the Dead, and so we had Gary Clark, and we had Joe Pilato, and we were supposed to have John Amplis, but John forgot his phone in his office. Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember. I do remember that, I'm so sorry.
Oh, Piffle, you were on later when we did the Romero show. On now. You're fine, John.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. But I'll tell you what, Joe Pilato did. I don't know if you ever listened to that show, but Joe Pilato gave you so much shit for that. It's not even funny.
Oh,
God bless his soul.
That. Of course, I don't doubt that at all, you know. I was actually, when I talked about being working in casting for Dawn, I got a lot of local people involved in it, in Dawn. Joe Pilato, Randy Kovitz, both of them were in Dawn of the Dead, and because I knew them, you know, from the theater stuff that we worked in together in Pittsburgh. So I've known Joe for a long, long time.
Yeah, he was a character. I, after that podcast and before he passed, we'd be on the phone every, a couple months or that sort of thing and just talk for a little bit. But he was a tsunami of energy. You could not control that.
He was. Yeah, that's the truth. He always has had a lot to say. No doubt about it. But Joe had a great heart, he was a baseball fanatic too. I don't know if he ever started spouting off baseball stuff to you, but
he did with me on the phone. We were both Pirates fans.
Yeah, we were huge
Pirates fans.
Yeah, he traveled the states. You know, one of his dreams was to go to every well known baseball field in the country.
Yeah,
I don't know if he ever did it or made it, but. You know, he was a huge fan.
Yeah,
it was a shame. Joe got really, really sick at the end, and it was he got to a point of no return. You know, it was pretty sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, I mentioned Ralph.
Yeah.
Ralph and I very, very close. I met him at Latino Playwrights, Henry Street
uh-huh.
Settlement, and he had just finished shooting Day of the Dead. And being a Pittsburgh person, I you know, glommed onto
yeah.
that. We actually went to the premiere in New York together.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Terrific.
So Ralph and I were real close. And
yeah,
and of course what happened is of course Ralph passed away in an auto accident in Albuquerque. And on his way there from New York, I had moved back to Bradford, Pennsylvania. He spent some time with me in Bradford, Pennsylvania, while he was on his way to Albuquerque to do that shoot. And I didn't realize until much later that he had passed away. He just disappeared, and I didn't know what happened.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was probably one of the last people to see him. And, of course, you know, with Gary, Gary, of course, basically took him under his wing. And during that podcast and talking to Gary afterwards was really, you know, it was good to know that Ralph was going to be part of that family. And that was really nice to know. So that's my personal connection to Romero and to the films.
Yeah, when we're on a Day of the Dead panel or something, Ralph is always talked about. He's well regarded and well remembered from the film. I didn't have the opportunity to really get to know Ralph because we were seldom in a scene at the same time. And plus I was teaching at the same time I was doing Day of the Dead. So I would have to come on set, do what I was going to do, and then go back to Pittsburgh, which was like an hour's drive from the mine. And so I never got to hang out with people during that shoot. But from everything I could tell, Ralph was a really great guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to jump in if I might.
You may.
Thank you. And the reason I want to jump in is because I feel a little it's a little bittersweet for me because I listened to both you and Carl John there talking about these people that you were blessed to know.
Yeah.
And as someone who like this was all such so I don't want to sound fanboy, but this was all such this is a little legend. Right, and listening to you talk about Joe Pilato, you know, if there's one man on this planet I would have loved to have met, I would have loved to have met him. So I wonder, and I'm wondering if you could give me some insight into what was some of those scenes like. Like, I think an example of the one with you and Sarah, and, you know, we still don't quite know where John and McDermott sit, and we've got the military guys over there. And there's the big showdown where Rhodes is basically, he's going to have Steel shoot Sarah. What was the atmosphere like between takes on that? I gotta know.
Oh, well, you may not believe this, but you know, between takes, things just kind of, at least in my little world, I step away and. I don't think about too much between takes. I kind of mind my own business. But Joe was definitely he was a force to be reckoned with. There was no doubt about that. I admire him. He put every ounce of energy he could muster into pretty much every scene he was in. And I think because of his bravura and his bravado, You know, he made Day of the Dead a really serious movie, I think. His energy could not be topped by anyone.
I can't watch a zombie movie where their deaths are being pulled out without hear him going, "Joke on them!"
Yes. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a trick.
That's an amazing scene.
Improvised or was that in the script?
No, that was in the script. He was gonna get pulled apart. Now there may have been some improvisation in terms of how, but Savini had all of the special effects well in hand, as per usual. That was the first film that. Here's my mind again. It's off into the clouds. What's his name? God damn it. Special effects guy.
Savini.
The other one. Nicotero.
Nicotero. There we go. Greg Nicotero.
Yes, that was. Greg had a role, but he also worked on with Savini on the special effects.
Right.
The word is, they were going to shoot that scene, and they had gotten some kind of fresh intestines and the like. In order to, when they were going to pull him apart, and they had to stop shooting for a little bit. And what I recall is that the intestines and the guts that were used when they went to shoot the scene, the power had been off for a while. And so
they were stored in a refrigerator. I remember this from Joe.
The power
went off, and they opened up the refrigerator, and it smelled to high heavens. And Joe looked at George Romero, says, "You mean I gotta fucking get in that shit?"
And they
he said
it.
That on the podcast. I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, and Joe did. He played it, man. He played it to the hilt. God bless him.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was, from what I hear, it was a pretty big mess. but I don't know if I would have gone through with it.
Well, I'll tell you one other story, and this has to do with Ralph. Ralph and I were talking, and this was in New York after he did the shoot. And, of course, if you remember, he gets his forehead ripped off. And Ralph had this big fucking forehead, okay?
Yeah.
and he worked with Savini and that sort of thing. And he said to me, "You know, I made this decision that if they were going to kill me, I was going to go out laughing." He says,
yeah.
And the reason I made that decision is because I watched White Heat a couple weeks
Jimmy
before.
Cagney.
All right.
He said he got it from Cagney.
Oh, I love Cagney.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, he got
Ralph
that from Cagney.
I do remember that Ralph had developed this wonderful cackle. All the way.
No, he didn't develop it. He always had it. Trust me.
Oh, did he? That's the way he is, huh? That's the way he was.
Yeah, we used to play poker together, Ralph and I. We do a weekly, or like every couple weeks, we get together. And he was one of the nicest people
that I ever met. I just love that man. You know, and
well,
and I'm working for the Puerto Rican equivalent of Attila the Hun. Her name was Carla Pinta, and he would like step in the middle, like you leave him alone.
Yeah.
And he's a little guy; he's not a big guy. And it's like,
I love
that man. I miss him a lot. I miss Ralph a lot.
I bet.
Truly do.
Yeah.
So, back to Martin. I mean, I hope you don't mind always talking about Martin.
No.
I have watched this over and over, and there's always this, is he or isn't he a vampire? Or is it all in his head? Did George deliberately leave it ambiguous?
Well, he's a vampire in the sense that he does take blood, right?
Yeah. Psychological vampire.
He doesn't know how to, you know, be with a woman in any other way.
So all the scenes of him in the past is just in his head.
And the black and white, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. That's what I go for. I think it's a fantasy. I think it's a fantasy.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my.
It could be a family psychosis, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what I believe.
We can only go on what we see Martin thinking and perceiving, but we don't know if that's real. It could be a lie to us, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well,
I think I mentioned it earlier. I think, you know, there was an addiction there, an obsession caused by being told over and over and over again, this is what you are.
You are, right.
Yeah, coming from a family that's basically raised on superstition, that I can understand how that could mess with someone.
Right, and I think that's part of what George's point was to debunk all of the superstition, to debunk the old traditions that, remember, Martin keeps saying, there is no magic. This is not magic. I get shaky.
Yeah.
I need to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what works for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because of the moon, and it's not... One of the things that's not in the film that was in the original, long cut, is Martin did a lot of narration. But the point of the reason I say that is that it's good that it's not in the film as it sits, because it was just overkill. It was too much.
Right.
You know, and it's always best to, I think it's always best to edit, to trim, and not go overboard. And that's one of the great things about the movie. As far as I'm concerned, the movie really ended up being an art piece, an independent art piece. And in my mind, one of the best, if not the best, movie George ever did.
Ever right.
I would say in between that film, Dawn, and Day. And of course, Living Dead changed everything, okay? You know, but George just had such a great run during that period. Now, I'm going to go in a little different direction here. And so George, of course, we think of George directing all these, but there was somebody else involved too. And his name is John Russo. And John, I got to meet John at Monster Bash a number of years ago. And we talked about a film that John did that you were in. And that would be midnight.
Oh, midnight, yeah.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and the differences in working with John, because John, of course, then came with Return of the Living Dead, and was behind that series too. But how was working with John as opposed to George, and particularly if you got any Lawrence Tierney stories, please let me know.
You know, people always ask me for stories, and I can never come up with any. I'm not very good about remembering things that, you know, may or may not have happened.
Right.
Well, let's say may have happened. Tierney was great. He was as professional as it gets. He was easygoing, easy to work with. What I was happy about for Lawrence was that shortly after that, he got that role in Tarantino's
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
And, you know, he was great in it. And he was great in this, too. So, I mean, that's my story, is that he was a great guy. working with John he's not George.
No.
We'll start by saying that. But John is as smart as anybody. I mean, he's as smart as a whip. He's a great writer. Prolific as hell. I mean, he has, I don't know how many damn books he has out. When I see him at a convention, I mean, his table is just stacked up with books and things of that nature. John did something. That was one of those times. This was 1980, I think.
Hold on. I'll give you that second. That was, okay, that's 1982.
That's when it came out.
You guys there? 1982.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was doing a play at the same time. I was doing a play called A Life in the Theater. It's a three-hander. I was playing the young man in it, the young actor in it. It was opening night. And there was a huge Playhouse reunion for this play and for this production. And so we were celebrating 50 years of the Playhouse's existence. So it was a huge deal for me. And John called a shoot that he had to have me in, which meant that I was going to miss the after party and all of that after doing, you know, several hours on stage with this play. He wanted me to come and do a shoot. I forget what the scene was. We were all hooded. I think the Satanic Sister was in it. I was angry. I was angry as hell that he made me do that. So what I did is I got loaded at the after party and had a wonderful time. And I went, finally got out to the shoot, and I was completely drunk. And I just sat disgruntled under my hood
while they shot this fucking scene. Now, John won't be too happy about me saying that, maybe, but I think he's gotten over it at this point. We ended up being good friends. We ended up being good friends. But
film I want to mention, okay, is a film that I do not know. And I was looking at your IMDb. And it's a film called No Pets. And it was done by Tony Buba. Now, for people that don't know, Tony was, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was a sound recordist for George, correct?
On Martin.
Okay.
I was going to mention Tony because Tony is primarily, he's primarily a documentarian. No Pets was his first narrative. It was written by a writer at CMU. His name was Jim Daniels. Really swell guy. Who came from a kind of middle class, working class background. But a tremendous writer and poet. I'm going to jump back a little bit. Tony, as we just said, was a recorder, was the sound guy on Martin. It was Tony's house, his parents' house, and his grandmother's house that we shot all of the interior scenes for Martin. And his grandmother was. His grandmother was a little bit, she was old country, you know. She was, she spoke broken English. But she and I formed a nice little friendship. Well, on the day we were in the attic shooting Martin's demise, she was worried and praying for me that they wouldn't do anything that would hurt me up there. Tony actually does a TED Talk talking about that. It was sweet, wasn't it? Anyhow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Tony's mom and dad were just wonderful people. Tony's brother, Pasquale, also, he was an editor, and he helped George edit a lot of films along the way. Ultimately went to L.A. He's recently passed away a few years ago. But Tony and Pat were wonderful people and good friends of George's. So back to what are we back to now?
No Pets.
Oh, No Pets. Yeah, so it was this nice little, it's a kind of a slice of life film about this working class guy, you know, who has this apartment, seems to be down on his luck, no girlfriend. He meets a girl at a wedding. She gives him his number, and then he can't find it, or he can't. You know, the paper smudged or something happens, and he tries to look for her. He can't find her. He has a dog. One of the big problem is that his landlord, who lives upstairs with his wife, doesn't want pets in the house anywhere. So he has to get rid of his dog. So here's this poor schmo, working class schmo, that gets, you know, he can't find the girl he liked at the wedding, who, you know, has nobody, and now he has to get rid of his damn dog. So Lori Cardill is in the film, too. She plays the landlord's wife. She and I have a little evening of romance. And then the dog has to be taken away,
and off he goes. So it's this little slice of life. I probably didn't, you know, develop a storyline for you very well. But it's this nice little slice of life movie directed by Tony. And Tony's one,
sure.
again, one of the sweetest guys you'll ever want to meet. If you contact Tony, you can get No Pets. I think you can pick up No Pets for, you know, I don't know, $20 maybe.
Okay, well, that was exactly what I was
okay.
going to ask. Because I need to see this. This is actual.
It sounds good.
It is. Good.
Yeah, it's your other lead role that you had other than Martin. And nobody knows
I've never
it,
heard
John.
Of it.
See, if you had seen me on stage, I had a whole bunch of lead roles.
Well, that's true. Kidding. But unfortunately,
yeah,
I don't live in Pittsburgh anymore.
I know. And I don't go on stage anymore, so.
I'm sorry.
But Tony is on Facebook. So if you're on Facebook, look Tony up, become his friend, talk to him. He'd be happy to sell you a copy of No Pets.
Okay, well, that's cool. That's exactly what we'll do. And I'll make sure that I push that on ISF too. Now you have done a lot more than what we know you for. And I'm looking at your IMDb. You actually have some things in post-production and completed a mini-series that you're a narrator of. Is there anything that you've worked on that you would recommend for us to seek out? Other than
no, you know, it's I'm a strange duck, man. Maybe what you are seeing are some of my voiceover work. I have a website, www.johnamplisofficial.com, which carries a lot of my voiceover things. And I'm really, because I'm interested in getting involved in that part of the business. For years I've been saying this, but I want to put a studio in the house so I can audition from home and ultimately, you know, do voiceover work and maybe work for Audible or someplace like that. And I have, mm-hmm. I have about 10 or 12 pieces on there. I have 4 books. I have a little short reading from Martin on there that I just opened to a page and started reading, and I put that on there. I have something from Frankenstein on there, and then for the UK, I hooked up with a guy that's writing these series of what he calls the Caretaker's Cupboard, which is a series of kind of horror stories that he has written and that I did the narration for.
Okay.
So that may be what you're referring to.
Well, I've seen things like a master of ceremonies in a movie called Progression.
Oh yes, but that no, you don't have to see that if you don't want to. I'm not saying it's not a bad movie. I have a very tiny role. I went in one night, you know, to do this little tiny thing. It's nothing I have a major lead in or anything like that.
Yeah, okay. The thing is, I was just wondering with your, you know, what little film roles you're getting, is that all Pittsburgh-based? Do we have another, did something like a phoenix rise out of the ashes in Pittsburgh, or do we have another film sort of repertory group happening there or anything in film at all?
No, I think there are a lot of young independent filmmakers in and around Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Savini School has a film component to it in Monaca. Point Park has a film school now where I taught, but I was in the theater department. Two departments don't mesh very well, which has always been kind of I've never understood why.
I agree with you on that. I don't understand why either.
A lot of film actors came from the theater.
Yeah.
A lot
absolutely.
Of film, yeah. Well, here's the deal.
Absolutely.
If you're a good actor, it's because you have training. And if you don't have training, then get some. And the best training is for the theater. And it doesn't matter if you're in front of a camera or on stage, you've got to have technique. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. They look at actors and say, oh, well, I can do that. Well, you know what? I bet you can't. I bet you don't know how to approach the work. I bet you don't know how to analyze a script. I bet you don't know how to, you know, I bet you don't know how to walk and talk at the same time. what the stage provides you with, learning to work on stage for the theater, provides you with technique. Now, to be really good, you have to have talent. So you combine your technique with talent. Technique just helps you utilize that talent. It doesn't get in the way of your talent. It helps to enhance it. It teaches you how to use what you already have. That's what talent is. Talent is innate ability to do something. Technique is how to do it. So you put those two things together, you got the perfect combination of ability. And I agree with you. You know, training on stage is what you need in order to go into film. And there's no difference in acting between movies and theater. It's all the same. There are a couple of things that, you know, happen differently. You shoot out of sequence in a play. You go scene by scene by scene by scene. Has to be done from front to back. But other than those minor things, the actor still is communicating with another actor. And you have to know how to do that. And the way to do that is learn how to do it through classes and theater classes. And don't think about there needs to be some kind of difference between movies and stage, because there doesn't. And anybody
did you have a preference, Ojun?
I would, at this point, I would rather do film. But at this point, I'm 71, so I don't want to do anything.
Well, there goes what I was about to ask you.
Well, like I said at the top of the show, I'm going to do a reading on Zoom for actually a couple of my students that I taught in college. They've lived in New York for the past 20 some years, and they're doing a reading of a Sean Wallace play that they've asked me to be a part of. So I'm going to do that. But I don't have any major plans to get out into the world and try to act again.
I was going to ask you if you ever thought about maybe directing.
I directed, I said earlier, I think before you came on, I've probably been in 100 productions, and have 50 of them I've acted in and 50 of them I've directed. So I've done a lot of directing. And at the end of my tenure at the Playhouse, I did more directing than I did acting. But the last time I was on stage as an actor was probably about 6 or 7 years ago in a play that was turned into a movie called August Osage County. In the movie, it was Meryl Streep. But it was a play first. I played the father, who was only in one scene, and he's the inciting incident that spurns the rest of the play forward. And he has about a 15 to 20 minute scene that's primarily a monologue. And me trying to prepare to do that just about killed me. To do, you know, a 15-minute monologue. I just couldn't get it in my head. And so I was in my late 60s at this point, and I thought, this is it. I'm done. I am not going to put this through. Oh, my Alexa keeps coming on. That's part of my security. I don't know if you can hear it. She talks to me. She hears things on television and then comes on and, you know. I don't know that.
I thought I heard a jet plane earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be me.
Yeah.
The jet planes are me. Okay. Sorry, but we're right near Kennedy Airport. Give me a break.
Well, Luke, I know it's not my imagination. I was concerned there for a minute.
Well, John, we're getting near the end here. I don't want to leave you on too much longer. But please give us the information on the autographs again and your website. You know, let's do some pushing of John Amplis here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't push him too hard.
It's merchandise, not him.
Right.
We want to be nice to him.
You're nice. It's okay. It wasn't a real let me find my advertising. You can go on my Facebook page and find this information too. And it'll have everything. But I'm committed to this website, Authentic Autographs, and you have to sign up with them and get pre-orders. But the name of the company is Authentic Autographs, and if you do happen to go on my Facebook page, you'll see the ad. They're pushing Creepshow right now, but it'll have all the information you need to sign up with Authentic Autographs and Zobe Productions. Zobe Authentic Autographs. That's what it is. And if you happen to want to purchase, or you can send in an item of your own to them. They will get it to me, I will sign it, and then I will personally give to you a video shout-out. I will send a video thank you directly to you. So, look for that, and just look up Zobie, Z-O-B-I-E, Authentic Autographs. And check out my ad, and you can get any of my films, photos from any of my films with George, and you can and you will get a. I will personally give you a video shout out. How's that?
Wonderful.
Oh, that sounds really good. And give us your website again, too.
My website is www.johnamplisofficial.com. And that will take you to, that will give you a bunch of narrations that I've done. They're all about 5 or 6 minutes long. There's commercials on there. I even have one. My son has one on there, too. He's pretty good. He's actually better than I am. So it has about 4 or 5 pages. It has about, you know, so go through the whole thing. It's better to look at it on a computer than on your phone because it gives you a wider vision of what you're able to see and get to. But look over. It has my filmography on there, my Romero filmography, and a couple of other things that you might, you know, find interesting. And so, yeah. That's the deal. Did you hear all that?
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay, so I want to just give Rhymes and Danae one more chance if you have any other questions for John. Rhymes?
I'd actually like to ask one more if maybe. You know, John, I gotta be honest, I've always considered myself a horror expert. I didn't realize until this week that you were Nathan Grantham in Creepshow. I feel terrible for that.
No, don't.
But
I was dead Nathan Grantham.
Okay, so that's fair enough. And I've got to know, how long were you in the makeup chair for that prosthetic? That was like
heavy,
dude.
I worked with Tom for about a week. Doing all the things necessary to get that costume made. You know, he had to put me under plaster, and so he made a mask, he made gloves, he made the chest. It's kind of funny because I got a call. Tom's the one that tasked me. Because I was kind of thin in those days, and he needed somebody thin to fit in this costume, and the costume still had to look emaciated.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons he called me. So I had 2 weeks on the movie. About 1 week was spent with Tom. And then the second week was spent shooting. And I worked with some terrific people, Vivica Linfers, Carrie Nye. I stage managed a play, actually, with Carrie Nye at the Playhouse a little shortly after that. Carrie Nye was Dick Cavett's wife. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Anyhow, I spent about 2 weeks on the movie, and it was a lot of fun, you know. And I got to kill Ed Harris. That was cool. And then I got to rip off Harris.
He deserved that for his horrible dancing.
His dancing was awful. No rhythm. No rhythm whatsoever.
How uncomfortable was the rising from the grave scene? I had claustrophobia, and I can't imagine what that was like.
Oh, it wasn't bad. Honestly, it wasn't bad. You know, you would get in, you know, shortly before you were shooting, so I didn't have to be under there that long. There was a fan underneath it, so the air was cool. And all of that took place at night anyway. So, you know, it was pretty good. It wasn't that difficult. The mask fit really well. I was able to move the mouth of the mask because it was shaped to my chin.
So any mouth movements I did, I would move the mouth on the mask. So it was pretty good.
There you go.
Good.
There
you
go. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for being on. And of course, we had to redo this yet from yesterday because we had some technical problems.
Yeah.
So I'm glad everything worked out.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, because I missed it last night. So I'm glad I got to talk to you.
Oh, I'm glad you did, too. It was a pleasure. It was a real
pleasure. It's been a pleasure, yeah.
I always have a good time on interviews.
So just to end up here, I want to just, before we go, give everyone a basic idea of what's happening in the next week and a half. So basically, we're going to be off this weekend, but starting on Sunday, we are going to be celebrating Halloween week. We're going to be doing a lot of commentary watches. So Danae and I, on Sunday, we're going to do a commentary watch on Nomads, which is the Pierce Brosnan film. Then on Tuesday, filmmaker Joe Badon and I are going to be doing a watch on Jigoku, the Japanese film. And then on Wednesday, or is that Thursday? No, that is Wednesday. Rachel Elaine and I are going to be doing a watch on a wonderful portmanteau film called Tales of Halloween, including with several directors involved in that, and it's just a wonderful film. On Monday, Limes, you've got a show on Monday. What do you have planned on Monday?
It's actually Tuesday night. Tuesday night is the 26th.
I thought it was Monday.
Is it the Monday? Is that the 26th?
It is the Monday. Trust me.
Then I do apologize. I will shoot myself.
Okay,
no,
it's Monday.
Please don't do that.
Okay. No, I was just kidding. Yeah, so Monday night I've got on Terror with a Twist of Limes, I will be talking with author Mark Dowidziak, who wrote all compendiums on Columbo, Dark Shadows, Twilight Zone, but most specifically we'll be focusing on talking about Cole Shark, the Night Stalker.
Oh, cool.
Oh, I love that show.
Yeah, who was the actor in The Night Stalker?
Darren McGavin.
Darren McGavin,
yes.
Oh,
amazing.
I loved him. Yeah, I love
him. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He is
it's your fault, too. You're doing Columbo, huh?
A little bit of Columbo, a little bit of vampires.
Nice.
And on Friday, Adam Perrins is going to be doing his Halloween show, and I'll be on it with Limes, and we're going to be talking about our favorite Halloween movies and TV shows and all sorts of scary stuff. And Saturday, we're not set on stone yet, but it looks like we'll do another commentary watch. I'm still working on Saturday. But we're very, very busy this week, and
good for you.
It's a great time to celebrate Halloween. And then the day after Halloween, I guarantee you, I'll be going to the grocery store getting lots of half-off chocolate. I guarantee
there
you.
Me too.
All of us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. John, it's a pleasure, man. I really appreciate you coming on.
You're
certainly welcome anytime back.
Thank you.
That you got something else going on, or
if you just want to visit, what the hell?
Yeah,
absolutely. You're always
welcome. I work on the yards. I work outside all the time. That's what I got going on. I put in some rose bushes the other day, so my life is extremely, extremely excited.
You can come up to New Mexico and pull my weeds.
Oh, wow. You have weeds in New Mexico?
Shocker, yeah. I know. Yeah, living in the desert, we have weeds.
Well, you know, I was when I was in the Army, I was stationed at White Sands Missile Range for about 6 months. Yeah. I was down there and near Las Cruces. So I spent about 6 months in New Mexico. I liked New Mexico. Hated Texas, but loved New Mexico.
I live about an hour and 10 minutes from Carlsbad. So
I'm not. Well, this, you have to forgive me. This was back in 1969. So I'm not that familiar with the geography down there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyhow, loved New Mexico. Beautiful mountains. Beautiful sand.
Yeah, my family actually ended up in Rio Rancho above Albuquerque. So I know New Mexico rather well, too.
Cool.
So anyway, folks, we thank you very much for joining us tonight. And again, many, many thanks, John. Truly.
This has been a real pleasure.
Carl.
Yeah. Limes,
thank
are you,
John. Thank you.
Are you actually in London or are you here in the States?
No, I'm actually in Canada. Well, I am in London, but London, Ontario, the other
London.
So,
Ontario. Okay.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely to meet you, John.
Lovely to meet you as well. The guy that I did the narration, these stories on my website is from, I think he's from East London.
Okay. That's where I'm from. I'm from East London.
I'm trying to think.
Cockney.
Again, I can't come up with that. Oh, Lee Culcat is his name.
Lee?
He's a musician and a performance artist and a really great young man who's, you know, trying to, I don't know exactly what he's trying to do, but he's trying to do it. Anyway,
awesome.
I'm sorry for keeping you guys long here. I apologize.
Oh, no.
Not at all.
John, it's been, again, you know, this is a great thing to have you on. Well, and you know, I didn't say much, but I'm a Pittsburgh boy. Okay?
Yeah.
And George meant a lot to me, and of course, I remember seeing Martin in 1976 at a midnight show. And had such an effect on me, and just the pride and to know that you know how much you know we revered George and his films and also the people involved. So that reverence always goes to you too. And
thank
so
you
this
so
is a,
very much.
A real pleasure and a real let's just say it's a pleasure and an honor to have you on.
Thank you.
Here.
I appreciate
thank you
here.
So much.
Thank
you.
It is my pleasure to all of you. I had a great time. We laughed,
awesome.
We talked, and that's the best we can do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm
there
about to sing the Carol Burnett song. Excuse me, the Carol Burnett song. I'm so glad we had this time together.
Nice.
Oh no, it's the Mormon Tubercular Choir.
That's lovely. Listen, you should go on my Facebook page because just go through it. It'll go through it. You'll find a lot of cool stuff. Certainly about George and certainly about me. And, you know, you'll get a little bit more insight as to how this old man is living these days.
All right.
Excellent. Done deal.
Yep.
Okay, all right,
well,
take
listen,
care, guys.
Again, thank you very much. And we're going to all say good night together. So one, two, three. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you much, John.
Good night.
Thank you,
my
guys.
My pleasure.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.